children were no longer in the van. Officers tracked him down and arrested him. One child was taken to a Milwaukee area hospital with serious injuries. The other was taken to a local hospital, treated, and released. Several Wisconsin high school students walked out of school to support gun rights. It was part of the National Stand for the Second demonstrations. Hemeta Condi has the story.
Will Riley, a high school senior in New Mexico, organized the so-called Stand for the Second walkouts with support from a Tea Party group. In Milwaukee, 9 Marquette University high school students walked out. They said more students would have participated, but feared getting in trouble with the school. Principal Jeff Monday says they didn't know of the walkout until this morning.
You know, we would really encourage that they take the right steps to have something that they believe in organized in a way that might bring forward their message in a positive way to the entire school community.
10 students walked out from Sun Prairie High School and 3 walked out from South Middle School in Eau Claire. Hemeta Condi, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now 11 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers made it a clean sweep of Cincinnati with a 3-1 win last night. Cubs lost to Colorado 11-2. White Sox lost to St. Louis 3-2. Brewers and Cubs are off tonight. The White Sox host Minnesota. NBA playoffs yesterday, Utah beat Houston. Now check on the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, 3rd of May already. We'll see light rain, possible thunderstorms off and on today, along with some morning fog. Today's high 69 inland, but cooler near Lake Michigan. Tonight, then, more rain showers and thunderstorms are likely. Overnight low 55. Friday, partly to mostly sunny, 30% chance of some lingering morning rain. Friday's high 73. We have a couple extra seconds here. Let's look at the weekend. Saturday, sunny and mild, 75. Sunday, partly sunny, 30% chance of light rain, a high of 60. Here are the current numbers. Wind from the east at 4. Looking at the radar, the rain is now over the lake. Currently 51 degrees in Racine. It is 50 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:12, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. Support for the morning show comes from UW Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with a new master's in mental health and counseling from Parkside. Visit uwp.edu. The first half of today's morning show is with the author of a book called You Play the Girl, Playboy Bunnies, Stepford Wives, Train Wrecks, and Mixed Messages.
So tell our listeners about the story with which you begin the book. It's really a story involving you and your young daughter and some of her interesting preferences that really got you thinking about the way that the stories we tell speak to us on a very deep level about what is most valuable.
Well, anyone who has a young daughter, or probably a young boy too, knows that they love to hear the same story over and over and over again, and they kind of fixate on one story when they're 2, 3 years old, 4 years old. And my daughter completely fixated on Sleeping Beauty, and just to the point where we had to read it twice every night, and she recited the lines and, you know, just played the parts, and it was really, really funny. But after reading it so many times, I really started thinking about what the message was in all these princess narratives, and how much the princess narrative dominated what was available to girls her age, and also I recognized that girls really were obsessed with this princess narrative, and I started thinking about why. And one day I happened to see this really beautiful illustrated edition of Alice in Wonderland, and I bought it and I brought it home and I started to read it to my daughter, and she just shut me down. She hated it. And after she went to bed, I finished reading it, and I realized I hadn't actually read Lewis Carroll's version growing up. I'd probably read the little Disney golden book, the abbreviated version, and I was really struck by how much it resonated with me, because it reminded me of my own experience as a movie and TV critic, which I'd been for 10 years at the time.
Mm-hmm. And so, go ahead.
Oh, just that Alice's trip down the rabbit hole was so resonant, and it so reminded me of what it was like to spend hours and hours and hours literally in the dark, like looking at these other stories that felt so nonsensical to me and that didn't reflect my experience and that I kind of couldn't really find myself in or see myself reflected in or make any kind of sense of. And I was like, wow, this is what the culture is like for girls. Hmm. You know, this is what we are all a sort of Alice in Wonderland character in a world that is kind of reflecting this nonsense back to us.
And I think what's really intriguing about your book, You Play the Girl, is that you highlight certain examples of this that are really overt and, one would hope, pretty much unmistakable to most of us. But you also mm-hmm. look deeper in other stories that, at least at a glance, would seem to be telling fairly affirmative stories for
Absolutely.
Young girls, but that beneath the surface, maybe beyond the obvious, there are ways in which they are telling a story that is not quite as empowering as we might hope. I think, for instance, you have some very intriguing insights on that Disney blockbuster Frozen. Share with our listeners kind of your thoughts on how this story is not necessarily quite as positive for girls as we might think.
Yeah, it's true. You know, for me, part of this, the experience of writing the book was trying to dig and figure it out for myself. I sort of led with feelings, like whenever I would watch something and I would just have feelings that I couldn't quite make sense of, like this doesn't quite sit right with me, but logically, you know, I understand that this story is supposed to be positive or empowering. I don't quite know why it's making me feel, you know, something's not quite right. And Frozen was definitely an example of that. I saw it probably 100 times with my daughter. And, you know, I want to just hearken back to like an earlier essay. When I was little, I used to watch reruns of I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched. And those also were shows about powerful women, you know, women with magical powers who were also like Elsa, blonde, beautiful, and incredibly powerful with magical powers. And yet the whole show, both those shows were about how they had to be contained or else everything would be ruined. And usually what would be ruined was like their, you know, either their husband or their master's career and just civilization in general. And then you flash forward to Frozen and you have a very similar character, except this time there's no humor in it. It's actually presented almost as a tragedy. And you have a character who's a legitimate heir to the throne. She's a princess. Her ascension isn't contested by anybody. Her parents die. She's going to become the queen, but she has these secret superpowers that she that her parents have kept secret from everybody, and they've kept her locked up in a room her whole life, you know, because they're ashamed and everyone's ashamed, and And, you know, the whole movie is about how she must be contained. And then when she gets angry, her powers come out, and she outs herself and has to run away to this, you know, frozen mountain to be by herself because she's such a horrible freak. So it's a really interesting thing, like, that, you know, I'm talking about three different stories, and that have taken, you know, that are like 40 years apart or however long apart they are, that still talk about women and power in a way that's really, really troubling, I think. And especially when you think about that, you know, a year or two after Frozen, when you think about Hillary Clinton's candidacy, you know, and how we think about powerful women. Mm. And I think that, you know, we don't stop to really question what's really at the root of these fears. And, you know, we sort of accept, like, oh, of course, she's ashamed of these freakish superpowers. But if you role reversed Frozen and you said Elsa was a prince, not only was he the handsome, legitimate heir to the throne, but he had superpowers, why would he be locked up in a room? Why would he run away ashamed? Like, there's no real logic to it unless you subscribe to this idea that a woman can't have power. And that's a cultural belief that these stories kind of repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat until we believe that they are real and that they are part of who we are as people. And I don't believe that's true.
And I think part of the point here is that sometimes those things get stated very overtly, very clearly, and unapologetically, and then sometimes that message is conveyed in other ways that are subtle, but that doesn't mean that they don't get through. One of your lines in your Frozen chapter says, "Power is perhaps the most unnatural trait for a girl to possess." I mean, that is what this movie seems to be saying, and that's, we have to stop saying that to females of all ages, but especially to girls. And your book is full of all kinds of fascinating observations about all kinds of things, from Barbie to the Bachelor, and it's interesting. How do you write about the points that are still frustrating and of concern in tandem with those sorts of things that represent breakthroughs and progress in the right direction? Because, of course, I'm sure you would be the first to acknowledge that we have made some progress. I think the main point of your book is that progress is not nearly as dramatic or comprehensive as we might blithely assume it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I started writing the book, well, when I first had the idea of writing the book, I did not think that we had made any progress. So I had the idea in like 2007, 2008, which I think was kind of a backlash moment. And it was around the time that there were all these bromance comedies and that the role of the girl in the mainstream, especially in mainstream studio comedies, was really prescriptive and really kind of punishing. Like, you know, at the time, the Judd Apatow comedies were like, you know, Knocked Up was particularly, you know, rubbed me the wrong way. Like, the women were all brittle and bitter and just had very constrained lives. They had no friends, you know, were just, it was just very limited points of view, limited characters. And I remember at the time, I read an interview with the actress Isla Fisher, and she was asked if after she did the movie, the Wedding Crashers, if she'd been offered lots of parts, leading roles in comedies, and she said that she hadn't, and that she realized at the time that in Hollywood all the parts are written for men and you play the girl. So at that time, you know, my point was to say, wow, like, I grew up a sort of in a post-feminist generation thinking that I could do whatever I wanted, you know, watching Free to Be You and Me when I was little, and thinking that all that was behind us, you know, sort of a product of the second wave feminist, like, media moment as a child. But then we we went back. So I was like, why are we here now? That was the genesis of the book. And then as I wrote it, things started to change for the better once again. And by the time it came out, we had this kind of all kinds of amazing breakthroughs, I think, in television in particular, and all these amazing new voices on TV that are now, you know, I think represent this incredible moment. And yet at the same time, politically, we went, you know, radically in the other direction. So there's this tension always exists. And I think the book just tries to grapple with that and tries to show how we can't, you know, progress is never permanent, never total. We can't, you know, these forces are always there kind of pulling us back. They sometimes we think, okay, you know, I feel like I grew up in a moment where you couldn't even talk about feminism. You couldn't talk about, you know, sexism in the workplace. If you did, you were whining and you were blaming, you know, someone other than yourself for your own failures. And I think, you know, when we look back on it now, we realize, like, of course, you know, there wasn't an even playing field. And of course, we were dealing with all kinds of biases and things that had not been fully dealt with and still haven't been fully dealt with. But at least we can talk about it now. So that's progress.
Absolutely. I think your book, yes, is a nice chronicle of partly where we've been and where we seem to be headed. It is a fascinating and wonderful and often funny book as well. You play the girl on Playboy Bunny, Stepford Wives, Trainwrecks, and other mixed messages published by Mariner Books. Karina Chakana, great to speak with you. Thank you so much, and congrats on this book and the awards that it has won.
Thank you, Greg.
And coming up shortly in part two of The Morning Show, author Andrew Yang, his book is called The War on Normal People.
Spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with a gentleman by the name of Andrew Yang, who has, in a sense, raised an alarm quite compellingly in an intriguing new book called The War on Normal People, The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future. It is Andrew Yang's contention that the developments that we have made in technology, particularly when it comes to matters of robotics, automation, artificial intelligence, are also causing what he calls the great displacement, in which an enormous number of particularly lower tier jobs are disappearing, never to return again. And this phenomenon is, of course, wreaking havoc in the lives of many, many people. And while we are in an economy that in certain sectors is in all sorts of ways thriving and quite exciting and shows great promise for the future, it is also an economy that, at least as Andrew Yang sees it, is leaving many people behind. And, of course, that in itself causes then all sorts of social ills and economic ills as well. And Andrew Yang comes to this story and to this concern as someone who has worked quite a lot in the technology industry has been a part of a number of different companies, now the founder of something called Venture for America that we will also talk about as well. His book, again, is called The War on Normal People, The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future, published by Hachette. Andrew Yang, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about this thing in the introduction of the book called The Great Displacement. When did it begin, and just how drastic a displacement are we talking about?
Well, it started around the turn of the century in earnest, where we saw the automation of 4 million manufacturing jobs in Wisconsin and other places between 2000 and 2015. And those jobs hit the communities that used to house them very, very hard, where as these manufacturing companies closed, the former manufacturing workers often had a hard time finding new opportunities and often went on disability and left the workforce entirely. So that hit Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania very hard, and in my opinion, led to Donald Trump's electoral victory in 2016.
This displacement is felt especially where? In what sectors of our economy? What kind of jobs specifically are disappearing?
Well, there are two types of jobs that are under threat, very, very broadly defined. Routine physical jobs and routine cognitive jobs. So routine physical jobs, manufacturing labor is the most prominent example. But if you look at the top five job categories in the United States, the first is administrative and clerical work, which includes call center workers. The second is sales and retail. The third is food service and food prep. The fourth is truck driving and transportation. The fifth is manufacturing. All five of those job categories, which comprise about half the American workforce, are about to shrink significantly due to technology and automation. Call center workers will be replaced by AI in the next 10 years. 30% of malls are going to close in the next 4 years due to all of the commerce heading online to Amazon. Many fast food restaurants are already automating front of house functions. Truck driving is the one that people should be most concerned about because truck driving is the most common job in 29 states. And my friends in Silicon Valley have enormous incentives to automate truck driving, $168 billion in cost savings and productivity gains per year. And so you can see on the other side of that, 3.5 million truck drivers around the country, 94% male, making $40,000 to $50,000 on average. Average age 49, that their opportunities, just like the manufacturing workers, after truck driving, are not going to be nearly as stable or lucrative. So that's the war on normal people, is that we have smartest people in the country fueled with tens of billions of dollars looking to automate away labor costs that will impact more and more Americans very, very quickly.
What's kind of intriguing about you writing this book is that you have worked extensively in the area of technology. In a sense, you understand this industry from the inside out. You have been part of it, and you understand what's driving it. And I wonder at what point it started to occur to you that that something was wrong.
Well, I spent 6.5 years as the founder and CEO of Venture for America, a nonprofit I started in 2011 to help train hundreds of young entrepreneurs to create jobs and businesses in Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, Baltimore, and other cities around the country. And it was during this time I came to realize that technology was eliminating many more jobs than it was creating. And I do have many friends in New York and Silicon Valley technology companies that 100% know that what they're doing is going to eliminate large swaths of labor. I mean, that's, if you're a technology company, you're looking at helping other companies do things more efficiently quite often. And one of the greatest cost lines in any organization is labor. And so technology companies are often very deliberately focusing on reducing labor costs, which often means making people redundant.
You tell us that some of the friends that you have in the technology industry are actually fearful of a backlash. And of course, to some extent, that is something that is already being seen. Explain what you mean, though. What kind of a backlash do some of these people in the technology industry actually fear?
Well, many technologists have very low confidence in government, with good reason, because our government is literally 50 years behind the curve on this. It's embarrassing. It's one reason I'm running for president as a Democrat in 2020 is because I feel like there's such an absence of leadership in this area, which to me is the central economic story of our time, which is that we're going through the greatest technological shift in human history, and our government's asleep at the switch. But the technologists, one, they know what they're doing, and two, they're geared to think about what the future holds. That's their profession to some extent. And so if you play this out and you say, okay, we send the truck drivers home, the malls close, fast food restaurants become automated, call centers become automated, you have more and more people with less and less to do, and in our current system, they will be pushed into economic deprivation. And eventually, it's likely that there will be some kind of violence, protests, unrest. And so many technologists are buying homes in remote locations just to have some place to escape to in case things get very, very unpleasant.
So you know people in the technology industry who actually have a tangible fear that the situation could turn ugly even to that extent, and they are holding these fears even at the same time that their own efforts in their own industry are perhaps driving such events to occur.
Yes, that's 100% correct. And the reason why is that we are driven by what one technologist called the master market intelligence, which is there are tens of billions in economic incentives for these individuals and companies to automate more and more work. And that's what guides them every day. You know, some of them are part of public companies and they have quarterly earnings to maintain and improve. So they're just going about this and they don't think anything is going to change or stop it. They are probably right unless we as a people get our acts together very, very fast. We are going to automate away millions of American jobs in a way that's going to completely destabilize society.
We're speaking with Andrew Yang about his book, The War on Normal People, The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future. There are some people who would argue that what we are seeing is something that we have seen before. That is, there's all kinds of old technologies that wink out of existence in favor of new economies and all kinds of jobs that simply do not exist anymore because they simply aren't needed. So in that respect, what we are seeing is nothing new. And yet what we are seeing is new in the sense that there are ways in which this is unprecedented. What are the ways in which this is very different from other kinds of technological breakthroughs in the past that also caused, to at least some extent, economic and employee displacement?
Yes. This is just a very, very different type of set of developments, and it's going to impact more industries faster that affect more workers. One estimate I saw produced by Bain had it at four times the rate of transition of previous dramatic changes, which also, you have to keep in mind, had significant problems. But artificial intelligence, software, robotics, are just self-driving trucks, are just a much bigger deal that affect more people than hydraulics and assembly lines. And even if you look at our past, with the Industrial Revolution, there were mass riots that killed dozens of people and caused billions of dollars worth of damage. It's not like it was a seamless transition. Labor unions were founded in 1886 and negotiated for 40-hour work weeks, overtime pay, and no child labor, and a bunch of other things. This time, it's going to be worse because there's no one to negotiate with. Only 13% of truckers are unionized today. So instead of there being some kind of collective bargaining, it's just going to be chaos and disintegration.
When we look at the emergence of technology, one thing that occurs is the creation of jobs, not just the elimination of jobs. I think you are arguing that numerically, however, more jobs are eliminated than are created. And I think the other thing you're arguing is that the kind of jobs that are created are jobs that are going to be, in a sense, out of reach of most, what you call in the title of your book, normal people. Explain the nature of the kind of jobs that are emerging in this new economy in the wake of these new technologies, and why these jobs might be difficult for many, many displaced people to even hope of getting.
Well, there will be tens, hundreds of thousands of new jobs that we cannot anticipate that will come into being as a result of these new technologies. But as you suggest, they will be for typically educated people with different skills in different parts of the country than the people being displaced. So if you look at the truck drivers, again, 3.5 million, most common job in 29 states, they're going to be replaced by some teleoperators in a warehouse in Nevada or Arizona that take control of the trucks by remote control. They're going to be maintenance people and remote and logistics experts that have advanced degrees that are trying to optimize truck routes that will be on the coasts. There will be some people that get into the trucks during the last 10 miles outside of urban areas, also on the coasts. But if you look at it, it's difficult for a 49-year-old ex-truck driver, ex-manufacturing worker, or ex-retail worker to somehow get that training. Even when the government tries to supply thousands of dollars in retraining, the efficacy rates are measured at between 0 and 37%, which is pretty terrible. And most of the time, workers don't have access to any retraining resources. They're not going to move cross-country. Often they have families, they own homes. That people are actually moving across state lines at lower levels now than at any time over the past several decades by the numbers. So new jobs will be created, but they'll be for different people in different places with different skill sets than the jobs that are being lost. And there are going to be fewer of them. There are going to be like 5 to 10 new fancy jobs for every 100 jobs that get wiped out.
And you are pessimistic about the possibility of new opportunities emerging to raise up some of those folks in terms of education and skill development and so on. You just don't see that being able to happen to the extent that it would need to?
Well, you just have to look at the numbers. I mean, the underemployment rate for college graduates right now is between 34 and 44% for people who are lucky enough to graduate from college, who now are saddled with $1.4 trillion in educational loans that are going to keep them paying school loans for the next several decades with diminished opportunity because they're underemployed. And that's right now. So imagining that we're somehow going to upskill millions of 49-year-old workers when today's college graduates can't even find stable careers is a fantasy by the numbers. And it frustrates me when politicians or experts very lazily say things that are factually untrue or impossible.
By the way, I was intrigued by the fact that one of the first pages of your book includes a quote from the founder of Foxconn. And as you may or may not know, Foxconn is about to open a gigantic factory very, very close to where our radio station is located. And it happens to be a factory that is going to employ at least in the short term, they are hoping that many thousands of people will be employed at this factory, but this quote from the founder of Foxconn in a sense, offers a disconcerting view of the future. Explain to our listeners what this quote is and what it means and why you've included it.
Well, the quote is, as human beings are also animals, to manage 1 million animals gives me a headache. And this was the founder of Foxconn in reference to the fact that he was about to bring in 300,000 robots into his factories to help supplement slash replace human workers. And he was quoted as saying this during a time period when 14 Foxconn workers had committed suicide over the preceding 2 years. And many of these Foxconn workers were living and working in the same place on like the giant Foxconn facility. So it's not that they like went home and committed to, they were home that way. So it was a statement by a CEO that employed 1 million humans. And one of the points I was trying to highlight with that quote is that if you are a CEO trying to get a ton of work done, humans are actually very complicated in a way that machines are not. You certainly need humans, but to the extent that you can replace them with robots, you're going to make that choice.
Because in a sense, there is something predictable and less complicated about a robot doing certain tasks versus a complicated human being doing those tasks. A human being who might get the flu or have little children to take care of at home or have squabbles with coworkers or any number of other issues that can arise and make things complicated.
Yes, or they might get depressed over working conditions and commit suicide and then cause very negative PR, which is what happened where, there was a global news story. So if you're in that position, then you'll try and simplify your operations, which means trying to make it as automated as possible.
Your book not only lays out a lot of numbers and your interpretation of those numbers in terms of where all of this is heading and the very real possibility that the great displacement that has already occurred to some extent is likely not only to continue but to worsen. But your book is also an exploration of possible solutions. And at the heart of what you believe is your belief that the free market cannot correct this situation, that we cannot leave this to the market itself to sort of rectify things, to bring things back into balance. And you really believe that the federal government is the only entity that can possibly meet this challenge and do anything meaningful about it. First of all, why do you believe that so firmly? Why should we think about the federal government stepping in to address this?
I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've been the CEO of a number of companies over the last number of years, and I can tell you how CEOs think. And the way CEOs think is we want to get stuff done and grow as efficiently as we can. And so when people are a part of that, that's great. But when people are not a part of that, frankly, it's even better. So one of the examples I use in the book is that Uber right now employs hundreds of thousands of people. Uber's priority is not employing hundreds of thousands of people. It's operating a transportation network. And so when autonomous vehicles come online, they're going to make that switch as fast as they can because it lowers the cost per service mile significantly. One executive in that industry estimated to me that they are projecting half of their rides will be given by autonomous vehicles by 2022. Which is only a few years from now. So the market wants to get things done as efficiently as possible. And decades ago, that meant employing lots of people. But today, it means the opposite. Today, it means trying to streamline your operations and get rid of as much labor as you can. If you look at the numbers of the modern technology companies, they employ a small fraction of what AT&T or Westinghouse or Kodak or any of those companies employed in earlier decades. They employ smaller numbers of people with higher levels of education and more specialized skills. And so the market is about to turn on us in a very, very big way. Like imagine 2.5 million call center workers around the United States. And then let's say one day, which is going to come very, very soon, a technology company says, hey, I have an AI that can answer customer service calls in a way that's indistinguishable from a call center worker. It's superior. What does that mean for the 2.5 million workers? The market is going to say, well, those 2.5 million workers now don't deserve to get paid their $12 an hour or whatever it is, because we have this limitless AI software that can do the same job at 5 cents on the dollar. And so if you use the market as your arbiter of value, the market is going to choose software, it's going to choose artificial intelligence, it's going to choose machinery and robots more and more. And so the market is about to turn on us. And thinking the market's going to bail us out this time is exactly wrong.
So why is it then, or in what way do you feel comfortable with entrusting this to the federal government? Is it simply because of the size of the federal government that it is that it has sort of the kind of pervasive potential of influence to do something about this, or are there other ways in which you feel like it makes sense for the federal government to intercede on this issue?
The federal government is the only entity with the size, scale, resources, and ability to meaningfully address these issues. 40 of the 50 states, I don't know if this is the case in Wisconsin, have a balanced budget amendment, which means you can't make huge investments that push you into a deficit. The American economy is like an elephant, and we're all like touching certain parts of it. You know, like I've got the leg, you've got the trunk, someone else has the tail. And that's what you need in order, you need a nation-level perspective to be able to see the impact of automation. And that's why the federal government is necessary. It's the only entity that has the resources and ability to meaningfully address this issue. Now, I'd like to say that that's horrifying because the federal government is has not demonstrated that it has the ability to rise to this kind of challenge. But it's the only entity that can even conceivably rise to this challenge. So that's the situation we're in right now. That's, again, why I'm running for president as a Democrat in 2020, because we need to accelerate the government as fast as the federal government as fast as possible to rise to the challenges of 2018 and 2020 instead of having food fights from the 1960s and 1970s, which is what it's doing right now.
So at the heart of your idea about what the federal government would do about this issue is the idea of creating the UBI, the Universal Basic Income. Explain what the universal basic income would be and what this would mean for the average American.
A universal basic income has a very rich American heritage. It passed the House of Representatives in 1971 under Richard Nixon and was championed by both Richard Nixon and Martin Luther King, as well as 1,000 economists who signed a letter saying this would be great for the economy. And what a universal basic income is that every American receives enough money to meet their basic needs independent of their work status or what they're currently making. So for anyone listening to this, what it means is that you and every adult in your family gets $1,000 a month, no questions asked, free and clear. Working, great, not working, great, you get $1,000. And that's meant to help you meet your basic needs, but also help activate the economy where you are able to potentially go to school, start a business, relocate for a new opportunity, pay your bills, pay for your kids' tutoring, whatever it is that is important to you, you get $1,000 to do it. And this was mainstream political wisdom in 1971 when it came this close to becoming law. And it actually became law in one state. Alaska in the early 80s adopted the petroleum dividend, where every Alaskan citizen gets between $1 and $2,000 a year, no questions asked, doesn't matter what else is going on. And it's wildly popular. It was adopted by a Republican governor in a deep red state. And it's been demonstrated to create thousands of jobs, reduce inequality, improve children's health outcomes, all sorts of great stuff. So a universal basic income is a very American idea that's been around for decades, and it's making a comeback right now because some smart people believe that our economy is changing for good. If you look at the numbers, every new job created in the U.S. from 2005 onwards has been a gig or contractor job without benefits. Our labor force participation rate is down to 62.9%, which is comparable to El Salvador and the Dominican Republic. Our life expectancy has declined for two straight years because of increased suicides among middle-aged Americans. Seven Americans die of opiates every hour. 40% of American children are born to unmarried mothers now, up from 18% in 1980. Our social indicators are telling a very powerful story that our quality of life is eroding, and to me, that's an automation story. The federal government needs to get its arms around this challenge and act as quickly as it can.
One quick word about what you just said about the benefits of the universal basic income. You mentioned job creation, that it created new jobs. How does the universal basic income accomplish that?
Well, if you look at your own situation, those of your friends and neighbors, if everyone got $1,000 a month, what are they going to do? They're going to end up spending it in their communities, at local restaurants, on supplies for their kids, on home repairs or car repairs. And so that $1,000 a month per person throughout the economy would create about 4.5 million new jobs and grow the economy by $2.5 trillion per year. And that's according to the Roosevelt Institute, which did a projection on what the universal basic income would mean. I mean, it's obvious if we all had another $1,000 a month to spend, we would spend it, and then that would grow the economy. This is a much more direct way of stimulating the economy through us, the owners of this country and its citizens, as opposed to shoveling money to the banks, which we did during the bailout where we printed $4 trillion for the banks and said, hey, it's going to reach people, we promise. And then it really didn't. Even this latest tax cut that the Republicans passed, a study just showed that only 6% of that tax cut actually made it to workers. So instead of insisting, hey, if we like shovel money to the banks or big companies, it'll somehow make it to you, why not just give you the money? And then it will end up fueling the economy directly. That's a much more sensible way to go. That's what 1,000 economists signed on to in the late 60s and early 70s. And then somehow we've lost sight of the fact that this is even a possibility, and I'm bringing it back. So the freedom dividend is the first thing I'm going to sign into law when I'm president in 2021.
What is the likelihood of something that, of course, to most Americans looks like socialism being passed into law and becoming policy? And how would such a proposal be sold to the typical American?
Well, there are people listening to this right now saying this sounds too good to be true. And I'm here to say we can make it true because we live in a true democracy. The freedom dividend would help 85% of Americans immediately. And it's actually a continuation of capitalism. Socialism, by definition, means nationalizing the means of production, which means the government takes over Microsoft or GE or something like that. This is helping consumer markets. Consumer markets actually function much more effectively when people have money to spend. So many Americans, including many of the people listening to this right now, think to themselves, wow, life would be better if I was getting $1,000 a month. We live in a democracy. There's no reason we can't make it happen. So to me, this is an obvious next step. I actually think it's going to be the easiest thing to quote-unquote sell, because for most Americans, this is just too good to be true. But we can totally do it. The government's already sending thousands of dollars per month to tens of millions of Americans. It's excellent at this one thing, which is sending large numbers of checks to large numbers of people very, very reliably and efficiently.
Well, your ideas about this are laid out in your book called The War on Normal People, The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future, published by Hatchett and the author Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang, thank you so much for making time in your schedule for this conversation. Best wishes to you.
Thanks, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
Monday on the Morning Show from the archives, I will replay the memorable Morning Show conversation I had with local theater organ legend Fred Hermes, who died the day before yesterday. I recorded a memorable conversation with him in his home, in the extraordinary home theater which he created.